This is an interview with Frank Annie Maness for the California State College Bakersfield California Odyssey Project by Stacy Jagels at 957 Lindale, Tulare, California, on Wednesday, February 18th, 1981, at 2 p.m. Okay, I thought first we'd start out with your childhood, when and where you were born.
I was born in Duncan, Oklahoma, which is Stevens County, Oklahoma, and we lived there for approximately a couple of years before we moved from there. There were two of us born there. I'm the third of four children. My brother was the oldest, and then my sister was next, and I was the third, and then his sister, just younger than I, which is the fourth. But the two of us were born in Stevens County, which is Duncan, Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm. What year was that?
That was 1915.
Can you tell me a little bit about Duncan, what size town it was?
Well, at that time it wasn't very large, however, it is growing now to probably it was 4,000 population, but now then it must be up around 30 or 40,000 people. And it is now the home of Hager Slacks. That's where the Hager Slack factory is located, one of them anyway. And it's kind of in the woods, which is the woods that is the blackjack trees and oak trees was just on the border between that and the prairie of Oklahoma, which is a little bit further to the west. But this was just in the edge of the woods, which is in Stevens County. And the town now must be 40 or 50,000 population. And my uncle was a businessman, and he was kind of a, I guess you'd call a small-time politician. And he ran a store there, and my father rented the land from him. That's where we lived when we were born.
And so your father rented land and was a farmer?
Yes, he was, at that time he was a sharecropper for my uncle, which lived in town and had owned the store. And after that we went to move to Ardmore, Oklahoma, which is further to the east, and that is in Carter County, which is about 75 miles to the east, and that was about probably the year 1917. And then after we lived there for a while, sharecropping, we moved to the city, got away from the farming, moved to the city in Ardmore. And in Ardmore, at the age of five, my mother died from fever. And so we were split up, and my grandmother took the two girls, and my father took us two boys. And we kind of moved about all over the state for several years before he remarried the second time. And I kind of enjoyed it. But I did have an awful lot of sickness. I came down with an infection and had osteomyelitis and malaria. You couldn't believe the malaria we had, and caused from mosquitoes. And also my mother died from typhoid fever, and then my brother came down with that a little while later. And then we got shots to keep the rest of us from taking the typhoid. But then I was really had a tremendous amount of trouble with this infection after my mother died. And I was in the hospital, I think, 57 days over that. And it left me quite crippled. I can still walk, but I've always been crippled from that. That was about in 1921 or 22. My mother died in 21, and then in 22, well then, I guess is when I had the trouble with my osteomyelitis. Then I came down with it later on. I had Bright's disease. That's a very serious kidney ailment. And that almost knocked me out, but I've managed to get over it. But I certainly had my share of the health problems, and I think mostly it was because of perhaps my parents didn't know how to take care of us, but partly anyway, and partly it was my fault, and probably maybe the nutrition wasn't as good as it should have been. But it was quite of a trying experience.
Did that keep you out of school?
Yes, it did. It did keep me out of school for a while. Yes, it did. But then we traveled around so much that after my sisters went to live with my grandmother, my father worked for a bridge builder. That is, he contracted building bridges. And we would go from one place to another, and I wouldn't really stay in school too long. In fact, I counted up one time. I think it was 22 schools that I attended. I know that there is a lot of opposition to taking kids from one school to another. And possibly that is so, but I learned to adjust quite rapidly because of having to go to different schools.
Why did your father move around so much?
Well, to follow this contractor that was contracting the bridges to build. See, he would take a contract maybe in different places in the state, and we would go from place to place because he wanted us to be with him. He wouldn't. Then after I think I was 9 or 10, after I think 5 years after my mother died, that he remarried, and he married a lady with 4 children, and it really caused problems because there were 2 girls and 2 boys, and 2 boys were twins, and they were just 2 years older than I. And then my father, instead of taking me with him whenever he went on the road doing construction work, well, he left me with them. And my older brother, which was getting to be around 17 at that time, went with him, which left me with my stepmother and all of the children, and it was like living in a home other than my own. And they made life rather miserable for me. But then after I grew up a little bit more, well then I didn't really get too much schooling. I think I got through the 6th grade. And then I left home, and I was getting to be a teenager at that time, and then I went other places because I didn't feel like staying with my in-laws, with my stepmother and all of her children, with my father gone most of the time. I'm sure he was against it, but then whenever he would come home, well then everything was fine, but it wasn't fine whenever he was gone. And so I left at a comparatively early age, a young teenager, and of course that meant cutting my schooling short.
And before you left home, and your father worked for this contractor, I wondered how things were economically.
It was awfully hard. It was very hard. In fact, finally, the depression started in 1929. And we weren't doing too well, and even with them working. But then, and after 29, well, then the construction bit stopped to a great degree. And then he went into sharecropping, and then you know what happened to all of the sharecroppers. They went broke in a hurry. In fact, he mortgaged the horses and everything, and pretty soon they foreclosed on that, and that left us without money and food. But at that time, though, I had left there, and I went to live with some relatives, which was lived in the eastern part of the state, and I lived with them a year or two until I got old enough to work. However, I wasn't really old enough, but I fibbed about my age and whatnot in order to get employment. Of course, the Great Depression started in 29, and then in 33, well, they did have some projects that was instigated by President Roosevelt for families and needy children, that were often needy children. And it was hard to get a job if you were just a young kid or single, and that's what I was. And I had an awfully hard time getting work. But finally, he instigated the word instigated wouldn't be quite right, but anyway, he had installed the Civilian Conservation Corps. And I wanted to go to there, go into that. But yet I wasn't able to. The competition for those positions were quite strong. And I wasn't able to do that. So when I was about 17, I decided that I wanted to come to California. And I think I remember having $13 at the time, and I started hitchhiking across the state of Oklahoma and into Texas. Now, in our travels, I had been across some of those places with my father, but there weren't too many cars on the road, but I was following the same route that we had followed before, which wasn't 66, it was some of the roads further south. And so I started hitchhiking across Texas and Oklahoma. In fact, I've heard of people walking out of the state. I literally did whenever I left Oklahoma. I walked across, I would hitchhike sometimes, but I actually walked across the bridge from Rowlett, Oklahoma, into Bourke-Bonnech, which was the dividing bridge between the two states. I distinctly remember walking across there. But it took me several days to get into Plainview, Texas, which is in the Panhandle part, and there I ran out of money. Couldn't go any further. But I did manage to stay with some people, and I even offered to work for my room and board. And I did find a job where I could work for my room and board, but then I still had the back of my mind of wanting to come to California. And so an opportunity presented itself in the form of this young fellow that I knew was going to go into the CCCs from Plainview, Texas, but yet I couldn't qualify for that particular job or position, because I wasn't wasn't a resident of that particular county. And so I did go with the young fellow that was eligible, and the next day they were going to go to Lubbock, Texas to try to get into the CCCs. And so I talked the fellow into letting me take his place. And he said, okay, but you're not a citizen. I shouldn't do this. But anyway, he did let me take his place. And then the next day, I hitchhiked and walked into Lubbock, Texas. And again, when I got there, I was out of money. And I went to the place where we were going to be examined and inducted the next day, which was the post office. And I didn't know what I was going to do because I had no money and had no place to stay. And I saw an army officer coming out of the federal building with the six fellows, which looked to be about my same age. And there was a stoplight there. And so whenever they stopped at the stoplight, they'd go across to the big hotel. Well, then I stopped too. And I thought, well, now's my chance. I will walk with them, even though I hadn't talked to the captain about making arrangements for a place to stay. And so whenever they walked across, well, then I got with them, and some of the fellows kind of eyed me and thought, well, what are you doing here? And we went into this hotel, and I remember the captain making arrangements for six fellows. And the manager counted us, and there were seven of us. And I don't know what I would have done had I had been something else. But anyway, I guessed right. It really were, they were going to the CCCs. And he made all of us get our papers out. Well, I had my papers. Well, he said, I guess I must have miscounted. So they went ahead and gave me a room and a something to eat for that night. And the next day, they gave us examinations. And yet I was afraid that I wasn't going to pass the physical because of this osteomyelitis that I told you about. And my leg was one inch shorter, but I kind of camouflaged that best I could. And so I did pass the test, passed the physical, and then they shipped us to what is now Camp Verde, Arizona. So that was getting further, closer to California.
How old were you then?
I think I was 17 at the time, 17 or 18. So they shipped us to Camp Verde, Arizona. And I knew that the conditions in California as well as other states were quite bad at that particular time, and it gave me an opportunity to have food, and I kind of liked it in there. And I got a job breaking in the auto shop in the CCCs, and I stayed there 4.5 years in the CCCs in Flagstaff, Arizona, and Sedona. We had a pretty good arrangement. First it was Camp Verde, and then Flagstaff in the summertime, and then back to Sedona in the winter. And ideally, it was perfect weather. You know what I mean? It was, Flagstaff is high, around 7,000 feet, and then Sedona would be nice and warm in the winter. So I did stay there 4.5 years in that. And so I learned I was a fairly good auto mechanic whenever I came out. And whenever I lived there, they asked me if I wanted to go back to where I came from after 4.5 years. I was getting up to the time that I actually came to California. And I said, no, I do not want to go back to Texas or Oklahoma, because I had remembered what terrible conditions were. And I said, I wanted to go to California. And so they figured out the distance, that is, that be the equivalent between Flagstaff, Arizona and Lubbock, Texas. And they said, well, you could come to the San Joaquin Valley, a little bit past Bakersfield, they said. I said, okay, I'll take it. And so that's how I came to California. At that time, they were trying to stop the people from coming in the state, and I bypassed that. Of course, they found out it was unconstitutional for them to do that. But they were trying to stop them, stop us nevertheless.
Could you tell me a little bit more about the CCC? Everyone was a civilian, but was it run kind of in a military
style?
Yes,
it was. It was the, it was, we had army officers, and one year we had a navy officer, an ensign. But it was almost like the military. In the at night, whenever we came home from work, yet in the daytime we went under the auspices of the Forest Service. And I liked the Forest Service, but I hated the Army with a passion. I didn't care for them because I didn't like this military aspect of having to stand at retreat. And when I was working in the auto shop, which meant I had to work a little bit longer than the rest of them to service the cars, the trucks, and so forth that took the fellows out to work. And I was unable to actually get in my uniform and everything for the 5 o'clock retreat because, I don't know, I just couldn't make it. And I was always in touch with the commanding officer, which was a lieutenant. I think that was his first assignment, and he moved everything to...
So they had you wearing uniforms?
Mm-hmm, yes. There was the Army uniforms that had been issued to the World War I soldiers, and I can remember I didn't like the bottom of them because they were quite small and seemed like we always had to joke that we had to grease our heels to get them on.
But you would only have to wear these uniforms after hours.
Or if we went to town, well, then we couldn't mix our civilian. We either had to wear civilian clothes or we had to wear the uniforms on the weekends. We had to either do one or the other. He wouldn't allow us to do both. And sometimes we would wear them to town. It was...
Did they give you leaves the way they do?
Well...
In the military, or was it freer than
at
that?
At first they did, but then some of the fellows got to abusing it. And then they stopped to her. The only way they would do it is if someone would get deathly sick, then you could. But they wouldn't give us time off like the American military. Yet I really got homesick to see my relatives. And one time I had them to write me a letter which wasn't the truth, saying that my father was about to die. That was in about 1936. I'd been there 2 years, and I did have a chance to go and visit him, which he still lived in Oklahoma at the time. And of course, he wasn't sick, but that was the only way that I had of getting out of there. I remember riding the train, and I went from Flagstaff, Arizona, and back for $21. They would give us a special rate on the train for 1 cent a mile. And so I thought it was quite economical as far as cost was concerned. So that was the only time that I really had a chance to get away from there. But
did you have what was then a normal work week of maybe
We had
10 hours a day, something like that?
It would be 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, unless, of course, we were in the Coconino National Forest, and we had to fight the forest fires and build the roads and so forth. But now if we had a fire, well, then the 40-hour work week turned into maybe much longer. Sometimes you would work straight through with no time off, and then I always complained because they wouldn't let us have time off to compensate for that, but they never would. But I really liked the Forest Service, and I made a lot of friends there, and I did learn a trade there in auto mechanics.
Do you think the work was hard? Do you think
Yes, indeed it was.
You and most of the other people
Yes, indeed.
In the hard
it was very hard, and in fact, some of the foreman, Forest Service foreman, would just come out and tell us either if you don't want to work hard, there are other people ready to take your place. So we did work hard. And most of the fellows I went in with, 88 of them from Texas, I was the only Oklahoman being as I did what I did, you know, kind of a backdoor type of thing of getting in. I went in with the 88 Texans, and some of those have become lifelong friends.
And you said you were an auto mechanic, and the trucks and vehicles that you repaired belonged to
the Forest Service. Forest Service,
And were there any other government vehicles that you were responsible for?
Yes, we had, of course, it was, they believed in hard work, and they did have the Caterpillar tractors and the Ingersoll Rand big compressors for the jackhammers and so forth and making the roads. So we had a lot of projects in the Coconina County, and they worked as hard, but it was good, I think. We made roads. And in fact, some of the roads from Sedona going into what is now I-17 we built. They call the Snibley Hill Road, and the word Snibley came from one of the founders of the town of Sedona. In fact, Sedona was named after Mr. Snibley's wife, Sedona Snibley, and the road was named Snibley Hill Road. It's really a winding thing. It comes out from about 3,000 feet elevation right into what is now I-17. Going into Phoenix from Flagstaff, and it was some road, but we built the roads. And
did you feel that the work you were doing and that the rest of the men were doing was valuable?
Yes, indeed.
It did.
Yes, indeed. In fact, we actually took the place of what we would now call the forest firefighters, like you, they bring in from different states to fight the forest. In Southern California sometimes, and of course they are paid quite well, but we did exactly the same thing, only whenever we didn't have fires, then we filled in with the erosion control and forest culture. We did forest culture too, which meant that we would study the trees, and sometimes we'd cut the limbs off of the trees and some of the big ponderosa pines and so forth, and it was something that the Forest Service actually wanted to do before, I'm sure, but they just didn't have the manpower to do it. And it was, I think the headquarters for the Forest Service in Flagstaff was in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and that's where we got all of our new trucks and equipment from. And it seemed like about every 2 years we would go there for our new equipment. But it was something that I enjoyed, and I still go back sometimes to Flagstaff with some of my friends are still living there. I go and visit them there at Flagstaff.
Have you heard some criticism of the CCC? I've heard some people think that possibly the government invented jobs for people that really weren't necessary jobs, and it was just a way to get people working and pay them to try to improve the economy. Actually, the work they were doing really wasn't that valuable. Have you heard any criticism of that?
I have heard criticism of that, but I think that it is probably, depending on the location, I think it was partly true and partly not true. Now, I'm sure in some of the areas, like in the Plain States, where some of the CCC boys were fighting the dust storms and so forth, or maybe they didn't have sufficient projects for them, but it just wasn't so in Arizona, because we had many things to do in some of the parks. In fact, Manzanita Park in Oak Creek Canyon we built, and it was it's still in use. Walnut Canyon projects that where the ruins are still there, and I know some of my friends were in the parks in Grand Canyon. Of course, they were under the National Park Service, whereas we were in the Forest Service. They did a wonderful job there, and they worked on the Bright Angel Trail, the one that goes into down the bottom of the Grand Canyon. So I think all of those projects were worthwhile. And then preventing the forest from fires was one of our main projects, especially in the summertime. Remember one time we had 60 fires going at once in the Coconina Forest. So, of course, a lot of small ones, but some real huge ones.
Do you feel that you were compensated very well for your work?
Well, if you look at it in dollars and cents, I think, of course, some of the fellows complained because we were only getting $30 a month. But then as we had an army chaplain that talked to us about that, he said, well, you really are getting more than that. You're getting your food and you're getting some schooling. We had an educational advisor, which we were getting an opportunity to better our education if we preferred, but they didn't force it onto us, but we could if we wanted to. So I did take auto mechanics in there, so that was valuable to me. And then we were getting our education if we preferred, we were getting our food, and we were getting a place to stay, and which was something, you know, because before I had nothing. So I think that possibly the criticism that they have had of not worthwhile, maybe in some areas, maybe it was justified, but in some areas, like where we were, I don't think it was justified, because I think that we really did some wonderful things there.
When you were telling me about deciding to come to California instead of going back to Oklahoma or Texas after the CCC, you said you didn't want to go back to Oklahoma because of the terrible conditions.
Right.
There. Could you tell me a little bit more about that?
About the conditions there?
Yeah.
Well, of course, one of the reasons that I didn't want to go back was because of I knew I couldn't go back to my father's because of the family conditions here, and I was convinced that the working conditions there were even worse than they were other places, and I simply just didn't want to go back there because of that. And I think from the information that I could get, a lot of people were leaving there, going other places, so that convinced me even more. And too, I had seen movies of San Joaquin Valley. In fact, I can't remember the movie, but it was this lush San Joaquin Valley of how that the pioneers had come in and had developed it and had used irrigation water to produce all of these things. And to me, it was really a good place to come to, and that's. Well, it was one of the reasons that I had wanted to come. But I definitely didn't want to go back to Oklahoma. I didn't want to go back to Texas. I had never been in Arkansas, and we always kind of poked fun at the people from Arkansas, which was unjustified, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm. Were there other reasons why you wanted to come to California?
Well, my sister and her husband, which I had been, by this time she had married, see, she was living with my grandmother, two sisters, and my youngest sister, just which I was quite close to, had married at a comparatively early age to a person that I knew in Oklahoma, and of course, and they had decided, too, that they didn't want any more of Oklahoma. So that was one of the other reasons why that I was sure that I didn't want to go back there. And I did feel like maybe if I could come and be with them, in which they had moved to not too far from Tulare here, maybe 6 months before I left the CCCs, and I thought perhaps I could come and be with them. And whenever the opportunity came about that where I could go any direction, the 600 miles, and it turned out to be here, that's why I came here. And so I came here in good style, rode the train. But I only had, I think, $3 or something like that whenever I got here.
What sorts of things had you heard about California that made you want to come here?
I heard that there were jobs here, and I heard that they had a lot of fruit here. And whenever, going back to the time that I had the osteomyelitis as a young child, one of the things they gave me in the hospital was the doctor said, well, I definitely should have iron. That's before they had the antibiotics and so forth. And one of the things they gave me were little red boxes of sun-made raisins. And there was this picture. I always admired this picture. And of course, I knew that it came from California. And I thought, well, if I could get to the land of sunshine and fruit and maybe I could get a job as an auto mechanic, then I would love it. And that was another reason I wanted to come. And of course, I knew that it was more populated in Oklahoma, and that would give me a better chance of finding work as an auto mechanic. I wasn't really a skilled auto mechanic, but I was I would consider a fairly good apprentice auto mechanic. And so whenever I came, I got off of the train and came to my sister's and my brother-in-law. And I was actually appalled at the condition that they were living in. They had a little tiny cabin and with two small babies. And she was unable to work because of the young babies. And they had one little tiny room and a little tiny kitchen and no stove. And they had rented this from a wino. I'd never heard of the term wino before. In fact, whenever they told me they were renting this from a wino, I said, well, I thought it was some person from a different country. I said, what do you mean wino? I've never heard that term before. And they said, well, he owns the cabin and he drinks wine all the time. So that was my first experience with wine. And I stayed there with him, and I decided it was really a horrible thing the way we were living then. Before it was they were living. So I was there, and I was discharged from the CCCs, and my time had run out too there. They had prolonged the ordinary the time, it was 2 years in the CCCs, but the reason that I was able to stay there was because I had a rating and had a better job. I was getting 45, so I was able to stay there 4.5 years, but then they told me, well, this is it, you have to get out, and so that's why I came. But then,
was your brother-in-law working in the field?
Yes, he was. And then that was how I started working in the fields. And it was in the fall of the year, and the very first job that that I got working with him was rolling up the weatherman had predicted there would be sunshiny. Well, it wasn't. It was raining. And they came and hired us to help roll up the raisin trays. You can still see them. That's whenever they first came out with the paper trays. And they had us to roll them up like a cigarette. They call it a cigarette roll to keep the rain from damaging them. And I really worked quite hard rolling them up. At that time I was kind of tough and wiry, even though I did have the trouble with my leg, and I worked exceptionally hard for this person. And then they had other people working too, maybe 10 or 15. And then after we worked kind of late in the night doing it, and then I remembered that they served us, I remember his name was Mr. Gillespie, and they served us cake and coffee after we did all the hard work. But after that, though, then he called me to one side, and he said, "Well, I noticed that you work quite fast and work hard. Will you come back tomorrow?" I said, "Sure." And so I got my brother-in-law to drop me back in his car. And then, by that time, the sun had come out, and the rain was over. And still, he wanted the raisins to dry more. So he hired me to unroll them with the pitchfork handle. And what I would do was go along and take the pitchfork and where they were rolled up and just roll them in the opposite direction, and then there would be the sunshine to come out. And I unrolled all of these grape trees for him. And as it turned out, I worked a month for him. That was my first job in California, in the fields. But I was never able to, I think partly because I didn't have a car to get around, and partly because I didn't have mechanical tools, I was not able to follow through with the job of being an auto mechanic. So we spent the next 2 or 3 years, I guess, doing just that type of work here in the valley.
With that first job with the raisins, how much were you paid?
25 cents an hour. And we were happy to get it. Because that meant that for 6 days a week, we would get $12 for an 8 hour. So we were barely able to live on, because whenever I, it was a little bit better for my sister after I started putting my $12. Before that, it was just my brother-in-law and his $12. But he was running the little cabin for $6 a month, yet they had nothing. It was just a very difficult thing to even live.
It sounds as though the person you worked for was good to you.
Yes, yes indeed. Now, some of them were very good, and some of them were very bad, depending on... That was another problem, too. We couldn't... you know, the length of time that we had to work for any one particular individual wasn't very long. In fact, it was a real goal for us to strive towards getting a permanent job. That was the goal of most of the Oklahomians that came in here. They wanted a permanent position so that they could depend on that. But that's where some of the trouble was coming in, is because we didn't... we weren't working all the time, and then whenever we were out of work, we had to go looking for work, which meant no income and spending our money for gasoline trying to find work.
How did you go about trying to find work? Did you hear from other people?
No, we just had to go out and look, and we would go to a farmer. In fact, because some of the things like picking cotton and some of those that we had done in Oklahoma before, that was nothing new for us. We went on the west side and picked away from where my sister was living. And there, it was so far away from our little cabin, and we had no place to stay, but when we sleep in our car and go out there and work for days at a time. Of course, that was piecework when we got paid $1 a hundred for picking cotton, and that was nothing new to me. But some of the work here was new, and I had to learn the best I could. And I would, after the cotton picking was over with, and like pruning grapes, well, then they wouldn't hire me because I wasn't experiencing. It is important to be able to prune the grapes just right. And so every time I would go and ask for a job, they would ask me, well, have you had experience? And I would say no. Well, it wouldn't hurt me. So what I did, I managed to get a hold of a pair of pruning shears, and I went and volunteered to prune someone's grapes for them free of charge. I think he had about a dozen. If you will show me how. And so he did. He showed me how. Oh, yeah. He said, okay, come ahead. And so I pruned the 12 grapes. And then the next time I went out, and which was the next day, and asked for a job, and they said, have you pruned grapes before? And I said, yes. I didn't tell them how many, but I got the job. But then I soon found out that that really wasn't that important, because they would usually have their own set way of doing it, and they would show you how to do it and do it their way. And so it really wasn't that important, not knowing that much about it like I thought before.
Was it difficult work?
Well, it was difficult in a way that because we didn't grow up with pruning grapevines, and some of the experienced people that had been doing it for 20 years could prune them faster than we. And it kind of hard on us, because it meant that we were being shown up, see, we're not being able to work as fast as they with all of the experience. But then it wasn't long until we were keeping up. And one of the places that we worked, well, first he didn't pay us, and we were really needing the work. And then another week went by, and he promised us, and all that. Then 4 weeks went by, and we were just down to nothing in groceries and gasoline money and whatnot, and he still didn't pay us. And finally we just had to quit, and he still didn't pay us. And then I found out that I could go and to what we call a labor commission in Fresno in the Patterson building. And I went there and I told him that this farmer wouldn't pay us for doing all of this work. And he said, what's his name? And I told them. And they say, oh, no, not him again. And which meant that he'd been doing the same thing before. And so that meant that we weren't able to get that money for, I think, about 8 months later, after he had harvested his crop, which was the following fall. And I think we finally got our money, but it didn't make it quite hard on us to, same time, trying to keep going and getting delayed in our pay. But by and large, the people were good. But then there was a great deal of negativism towards us, and I think mostly because of the fear, I think, of that maybe we would take their job, not necessarily because we were Okies, but just because they thought that they might lose their job to us.
And who were these people that felt negatively? Were they the people who had picked the crops before the Okies ever came here?
Well, some of the townspeople had a rather negative opinion about us, and I don't know, the snide remarks that they would make, of course I didn't pay too much attention to it, but it did bother some of the people. And then like, for instance, if we would go on a job, and they would say to me, well, where are you from? Okie, huh? Or they'd say, oh, just another dust bowler, or something like that. And I could sense that there was a great deal of negativism, even by the ranchers that we were after the work had been completed. That was the thing that really disturbed me more than anything else, was that they weren't as friendly after we did the work for them as when we were doing the work. I think that one thing disturbed me more than anything else, that really I had nothing against the people, but I was disturbed by that all the time that I lived here. It was different, you know, where we grew up. Of course, we would exchange work, the farmers, back and forth, and they were our friends. And, you know, we would see them on the street, well, we still considered them our friends, but when we got here, it just wasn't like that at all.
There was a definite class difference. There were wealthy farmers, and then there were workers who were usually very poor.
Yet, and some of those were just as bad off as we.
Some of the farmers.
It was absolutely, absolutely just as bad off as we. In fact, I really felt sorry for them, and around some of the years, but I would say a large percentage of the ranches were for sale, but banks, you know, they had foreclosed already. It was just a kind of a sad thing. Some of the large ranchers, like Tagus Ranch and maybe some of the others, well, they had a different system. No doubt they were making good money. Yet I had some friends that worked for Tagus Ranch that kind of liked the Marriott and some of those people. I'm sure that they weren't doing too well working for them, and they had the funny money that they had talked about. I never experienced that. However, I did experience some of the...
Are you talking about they were paid with...
Artificial money.
Money that was counterfeit.
Yes. Yeah, it was, wasn't... In other words, could be spent only in his own store.
Oh, like a company store.
Yeah, you know. And the areas in the west side where we were picking cotton, they paid us in... looked like poker chips. In other words, a certain type would be good for a dollar, and we could only spend them at a certain store, and the store's prices were high. Well, I resented that. I really wanted the money instead of the, because we had the responsibility of my sister and the babies that we wanted to take care of, and I resented the poker chips that they were giving me for money, and the place that we were forced to trade in order to buy food so we could keep on picking cotton. And I resented that type of thing, but as a whole, the people were very nice, and they were cordial, but sometimes some of them were very honest too.
Back to when we were talking about some of the townspeople that had negative feelings about the Uggies, you said they would call you dust bowlers when in fact you were in Arizona.
At the time,
the dust bowl.
I resented that. In
so
fact,
you never saw any of the dust bowl.
I didn't see any dust bowl yet. That. They called me that. And in fact, I got to the point of where whenever they would call me that, I would say, well, you're wrong, I'm from Arizona, which I was only telling part of the truth, because I had come from Arizona to California, and I resented them calling me a dust bowl or an Okie.
Do you remember any specific incidents involving you or maybe a friend or someone else where snide things were said, or maybe even some blows taken?
One time we got a job pruning trees, peach trees, and the fellow, we went there and asked for a job, and he had 200 peach trees, And I noticed that he had had about 12 or 15 of them pruned already. And now I ask him, what has happened here? And he said, well, I hired some people to, some oak, as he said, some dirty oak is to prune these, and I offered to give them a 5-cent bonus if they would finish the 200 trees. And I didn't tell him that I was a Noki, but I'm sure that he could detect that I was. But anyway, he says the dirty oak is that wouldn't finish the job. And he says, I even offered to give them 5 cents bonus. So I figured out that possibly with the price that he was going to pay us, I think it was 15 cents a tree, that possibly that we could make the 25 cents an hour with the bonus. And I said, well, okay, that sounds like a fairly good deal to me. We will do that. And he said, okay. And so we went ahead and did it, and I think it took us about a month to prune them. Then after we completed the 200 trees, then he wouldn't pay us the 5-cent bonus that he promised to pay per tree. And I said, well, how come? He said, well, I didn't tell you that. I told the other people that. I said, well, yes, but you implied to us that is what you would do, and that's why we accepted it. He said, well, it just isn't so. And so there wasn't too much that we could do about it. However, I think that he was afraid that we were going to do something about it. So he had the marshal to get after us and come and accuse us of swiping the neighbor's pruning shares, which had nothing to do with him at all, which wasn't true. Now, we had borrowed the neighbor's pruning shares to prune the trees, but we just hadn't taken them back yet. And so he didn't like it. And I'm sure it was nothing more than just a distractor. He got the marshal to come and accuse us of getting the, which wasn't so. But it kind of disturbed me that he would say those things and then turn around and beat us out of the 5 cent per tree.
Mm-hmm. Do you think very many other Okies had incidents like that?
Well, I'm sure they did. There's no. Just it was fairly common, and that I'm sure they did. And then there was a little bit of negativism, even after World War I, but it just took a long time for it to finally go away. But it. I have forgiven them. Yes, indeed, I have. But I haven't forgotten. I just can't forget. My wife said, well, if you've forgiven me and you forget, I said, well, I can't.
Yeah. Do you remember working with minority workers, perhaps Mexicans or Filipinos or black farm workers?
Well, you know, I did work with some Mexicans, and there were a few Filipinos around. There was an article in the paper recently that stated they were talking about the Chicano movement in the valley, and when they started in the strikes that they were having, there was quite an article in there, and they gave the statistics of the amount of a high percentage of the Chicano people that were doing the farm labor here. But my honest opinion is I think that the statistics are wrong, because there must have been, how many, 200,000 or 300,000 of the Okies that came in here during those days. And I would say that the majority of the farm people were Okies in the 30s. It weren't the great deal more of the Mexicans like it is now. It just wasn't. I don't know where they got the figures, but that's my honest opinion.
Of the Mexican farm workers that you did come into contact with, do you think they were discriminated against
of the course.
Way Okies were?
Of course they were. But, of course they were. Because, however, of course then they are still discriminated against. But I don't think that they were discriminated.
I've been told by some black people that were farm workers in the valley that they were not discriminated against. They were largely left alone. But the Okies were.
That's true. Now, of course, I can't, but I think that they were discriminated against. Probably not as much as the Okies, but I think they were discriminated against. But there weren't just that many of them as far as I'm concerned. At least I didn't see them. And of course, I think the history kind of points out too that Delano had a large portion of Filipinos that came in the 30s. But we didn't have too many Filipinos in right around here. It was mostly Okies and some people from Missouri. The government camps I stayed away from, I really felt like that competition for employment there was even greater than being away from them. You know, I guess they had one, what, in Weed Patch and one in Linnell and
Arvin,
Shafter, and all over. But and some of them are still in existence there. In fact, Linnell is still, they have people still living in there, and it government housing is what it was.
Did you ever consider living there, or did you just...
No, I didn't. I just didn't want any part of being in this large group of what I considered... I liked the people, but I just didn't want to live there because I felt like that it would be harder for me to find work if I did. And maybe it wouldn't have been. I don't know, but that was my opinion, and that was the opinion of my brother-in-law that they...
How about the living conditions in the camps?
I think they were better than where we were at, really. In fact, the matter is they did have, what, warm water and showers, but we didn't have that. We didn't have, if we wanted warm water, we had to heat it with their stove, which we didn't have, the little piece of tin. But then... later on, though, we did move from this one real bed cabin and found a little better place to live. But by and large...
Was that close by?
Yes, we lived in probably... it was kind of in towards Dinuba. We found a place over there. There was an old house that was vacant. Probably they were getting ready to tear it down. And so we lived in that and... We made raisin trays in our spare time to pay for the rent. Yet I think that we were discriminated there too because he was charging us $15 a month rent and we were working out by making the wooden raisin trays for him. But he wouldn't allow us to go beyond that, which meant that whenever we got the raisin trays made, then we had to go looking for work some other place.
Okay, we were just talking about the government camp, and I wondered if possibly one of the reasons you didn't want to live there was because it was a government camp. Did you have any feelings against perhaps accepting any kind of help or aid from the government, and you might consider the government camp aid?
Well, no, I really didn't feel that way about it, no. However, we weren't ashamed of getting government aid or getting welfare, but we soon found out that we weren't eligible for any of those things. You know, you have to be here for a year, I think, before we were eligible. So finally, we just gave up of even trying to get any help in that respect, and I really didn't have any opposition to the government camps, other than the fact that I just thought that the competition for employment there would be too great.
You were talking about the first house that you lived in with your sister and brother-in-law and your children, and you were appalled when you first arrived at how poor the living conditions were. There was no hot water.
There was no hot water. There was a... we did have a... there was no shower. They had just a one little tiny room in front and a little tiny room in the back for a kitchen. And the stove was something that... he didn't have enough money for the stove. He went and picked up a piece of iron, and it really didn't look like a stove. And that's what we did our cooking on, and that's also the thing that in the winter time, because that was in October that I came here, and then the cold weather started coming on, you know, in November, and that was the thing that heated it, and it was... so really, it was a bad situation. We had no bathtub, that's for sure. We had no shower. And we had the water, and we had the little tiny stove, and we had the one room.
Was there a restroom?
Restroom? Yes, I think there was. I believe there was. It's been so long that I don't recall it. It could have been that we had an outside restroom. But I don't recall having a restroom, but there could have been. But that definitely was the extent of it, I'm sure of that.
Well, when you came and had the extra income to contribute, were there still problems with enough food?
Oh, yes, there was.
Clothing?
Definitely.
Gas money to go and
definitely, definitely. In fact, I can't understand how that my brother-in-law was able to provide for my sister and the two babies with the only $12 a month, yet I was a little bit more of a burden, but then, you know, by staying there and food, but I gave them every cent that I had all the time that I was here. And then with my additional money, well then it was a little bit better.
Did your sister consider going and working in the field?
She did, but then our babies were, one was 9 months old and one was about 3 and a half. So it was almost impossible. However, sometimes we would take the babies and whenever the weather was warmer and put them in the car. And they were real cute little blonde, blue-eyed babies, and I remember we went there and left the babies, and my sister was working in the field, and then the high school girl came out and saw the blonde babies in the car, and she got her mother to come and look at that cute little blonde babies with such a bright blue eyes. They thought she was rather cute. But sometimes my sister would work in the fields.
Do you remember very many women and children working in the fields generally?
Yes, yes, they did. which was nothing new. Now, they did that in Oklahoma and they did it in California, so it was nothing new to them. In fact, some of the people would take the kids and have them to, like for instance, picking peaches or picking cotton. I grew up in a cotton patch, you know, and we were paid by the hundred. So it was nothing new for the families to take the children out and have them work in the fields, and they did here too. And picking grapes, it was the same way. It was so much a tray, I think we got a penny a tray for picking grapes, cent a tray.
And when you moved around various jobs that were just maybe a few weeks or a month long, did you go very far from the Tulare area?
Well, one summer I did. Albert, my sister, stayed here. One summer I got acquainted with a friend, and I went to Sacramento Valley across from Yuba City and worked all summer, and we slept on the by the riverbank. And it was on the Yuba City side on Feather River. And this one Corona that was accused of murdering those people and burying them was in the exact same spot that we camped. It was quite sandy there, and I know the way they described it, a mile and a half south of Yuba City on the Feather River side is where they were supposed to have buried. And every time I think of Juan Corona or something comes up about his trial, I think of this time that we spent there in Sacramento Valley on that very same spot all summer, and I thin fruit there for a fellow. But that was the only time that I went very far from this area. But then I came back and gave my money to, remember, I came back with $54. That was a lot of money.
Mm-hmm. Were there very many other people camping with you at that area?
At that time, there was just the one fellow and that I was acquainted with. And I had gotten acquainted with his sister, and I liked her, his sister. And I was acquainted with him. And I was going with his sister at the time. So the two of us went to Sacramento. It was his idea, really. But then after I came back, well, then I continued on the same area around through here.
Mm-hmm.
But and one time we lived near Dinuba, and sometimes we went to Five Points picking cotton, and it was there, it was quite miserable, and the farmer had some little, of course my sister didn't go on that trip, had some little tiny cabins there, and then they were even worse than the ones that we had at the first one, and it was even smaller and no heat. And there were, since you mentioned it, there were a few Mexicans there. And I remember one of them was needing brakes put on his car, and I thought, oh, here's my chance to put my mechanical ability to work. I would figure out some tools to do it with, but then when he got right down to it, well, then he didn't have the money for me to put brakes on his car. But then it was rather bad there too, and it started raining, and we weren't able to see it. So no to pick cotton, and whenever it's even damp,
mm-hmm.
and if it starts raining, well then you have nothing to do. So it was quite.
What did you do during the off season, say the rainy season, when it would rain for a few weeks at a time, or there was just no work to do?
Well, it was just a kind of a sad thing because. We would try to foresee ahead of time, knowing that these things were going to happen. We would try to at least try to save up enough money to carry us through. But sometimes our calculations were off and we would have problems. I know one time, my brother-in-law, I didn't go because he went to Fresno to see if he could get some kind of help from the welfare, and they said no. However, they said that they would give him some commodities, like groceries and so forth. And I remember he brought back salmon and sardines and a few things like that. And it was very good. And oatmeal, but that did help us. But I think he only did that the one time. And then one time too, he took a job as being a Watkins salesman. He wanted to thought maybe in the wintertime he could compensate his salary. But then no one was buying, and so he didn't make too much money, and he wasn't finally gave up on it. And they wanted me to try it. I wouldn't do it.
What did you do with your time?
Of course, we still didn't give up. We were still looking for work, just trying anything because mm-hmm. we had to. there was just no giving up. We just had to keep on trying, keep on trying.
How about your free time, say in the evenings if you weren't too tired, or on weekends?
Well,
was there ever any money left over for a movie or anything?
Oh,
like that?
No way. What we would do is sometimes that we like to listen to the radio. We found a little radio, I think, for $2, and we enjoyed living that. And then finally my sister thought that she would like to go to church, and we picked out a church that, and we did, and we went and we enjoyed it. And some of the church people wanted to help us. And that was kind of good in a way, but I remember them going to a church social, potluck social, I guess you would call it. And we didn't have, my sister said no, she didn't want to go, and I think that they sensed why. Because we didn't have, you know, food to offer. And they said, well, just bring a pound of oleo. And I had been in the CCCs, and that was when oleo first came out, and I said, what's oleo? They said, well, it's artificial butter. I never heard of such a thing before, but she went and got a pound of oleo, I think, for 12 cents or something like that. And I remember having to mix it, but the coloring, it was white, you know, when it first came out, and she had to mix it, and that was her dish for the evening. And so they went there and had the good food, I guess.
Did you continue going to church then?
Yes.
Had your family been a church-going people back in Oklahoma?
Well, of course, we were raised in what the psychologist would call a Bible Belt. And we were quite religious. However, I didn't always agree with my grandmother's religion, and I wasn't really a strong child, and I resented going to the meetings and having to stay up quite late and listen to some long-winded preacher preach until 11 o'clock at night. And yet they enjoyed that. They thought that was okay. But I didn't. And I really didn't accept Christianity until after I came to California. But I think that the churches did help some of the people. Maybe not in any great degree, but give them a place to go. And I think sometimes it did help them financially too.
Mm-hmm. How about making friends here? Did you come to have a group of friends or a community of people that
yes.
you felt at home with?
Oh, sure. And in fact, I think that it was probably some of the things that kept us going. You know, it was the fellowship that we would have with friends and this same girl that I was telling you about, that I was going with, that I went with her brother to Sacramento Valley, Yuba City. She still lives. I didn't marry her. I married someone else, and then she married someone else, and she still lives on Adams Avenue, east of Ridley, and they still visit with us, and she's a wonderful person. But I sometimes talk to them on the phone. But we did have our associations and our friends, and that was one of the things that really helped out a lot.
Mm-hmm. I know that you were trying to help out your sister and her children, and you probably felt some sort of a sense of responsibility
sure.
to them because they had opened their home, however meager it was,
right,
to you
right,
and given you a home. But did you at any point consider leaving and going back to Oklahoma or possibly going somewhere else?
I definitely did not want to go back to Oklahoma because I had remembered what it was like. Definitely did not want to go back. However, I did think of going some other place, but I really felt like I had a responsibility to my sister and to her children and my brother-in-law, and I stayed with them until the war broke out.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever consider trying to go into town and get some other sort of job that wasn't farm-related that might have paid better wages?
Well, yes,
or was that out of the question?
Well, that was almost out of the question because I felt like that I really wasn't that good of a mechanic in order to be able to get a job. And two, there was another problem. That was this. Most of the repair work, of course, the cars were simpler then. Most of the repair work was done by the individuals, and they really didn't have a lot of repair work to do. And I didn't have tools. And it meant, too, that I would be separating from my brother-in-law, which we had become kind of a team together. And meant that we would be separating, so I really didn't consider it until the war broke out. And then when the war broke out, well then, I did leave and went into Santa Monica. And by that time, that was in 41, then I did go to work for the Chrysler Plymouth place in 26 New Wiltshire in Santa Monica. And that was the first time that I was able to utilize the training that I had had in the CCCs. And they continued living here a little bit longer after I left. And then eventually they left here and went to West Hollywood and went to work. But then I worked at the Chrysler Plymouth place, a place called Ray E. Schaefer Chrysler Plymouth place in 26 in Wilshire in Santa Monica. And then we couldn't no longer get cars, you know, because of the war. And then I had to leave there. And by that time I was a fairly good mechanic. And then I took a job with Douglas Aircraft Company in Long Beach. And it was a rather a noisy place, and I really didn't like it there. And they had no windows, and the lights were sodium lights, and I didn't care too much for that. And the place being noisy, and then still I wasn't able to utilize the, they wanted me to be a riveter on the C-54s, and I wasn't able to utilize my ability, you know, to my advantage. And so I worked there a while, and then I finally took a job in West Hollywood in a machine shop there. It was called Cirillo Aero Tool Company, and we manufactured precision tools, and I worked there as a machinist, and then started getting a lot more pay, and it was a permanent job, and then I became a journeyman machinist, and I worked all during the war as a machinist. And after the war, about the time the war ended,
Did you not go into
the I did not because of the Alaska, right, right. I didn't. I was turned down for military service because of that. However, they took me in the CCCs, but then that was a little bit different from the military. Mm-hmm. And they wouldn't take me in the service, so they gave me a 4F classification. But I was able to work. I really felt like that I would like to have been in the military, but I wasn't able to go because of that. But I did do highly technical work in the defense plan and as a machinist. Mm-hmm.
And you were talking about after the war. Did you come back here to the
war? After the war, in the meantime, I had gotten married. And my wife had not lived here. And she wanted me to return to the San Joaquin Valley. And it was with a great deal of reluctance that I decided to come back because I had remembered what it was like. It was terrible. I just didn't want anything to do with it. But I had saved up some money. And with the background of working at the Chrysler place and then the additional mechanical experience with the machines and everything, and I did work in North American Aviation, too, which is now North American Rockwell. And I worked there as a machinist. And I was working there at the time that I came back, and I took my money and I bought out a auto repair shop in the little town of Ivanhoe, which is 7 miles from Visalia. You look on the map there. And I was there 21 years in auto repair shop there in Ivanhoe. And I enjoyed it very much, yet after the war, this same negativism still existed by some of the ranchers that I had experienced before. Had it not been for the fact that the town of Ivanhoe was made up predominantly with people as myself, I think I would have went broke, but I did was able to succeed in operating this auto repair shop because of their trade, see. But the ranchers, it was must have been 8 or 10 years before I started getting finally the...
What made you think that it was... Because you were an Okie, but you
know, well, I was, of course, there was no need for me to try to camouflage my voice. They knew I was an Okie. There was no question about that, you know, my accent. And they just wouldn't. And of course, there was some of the native people that had grudges there too, and I was in competition with them. And then that made a difference, and I simply just didn't get any response from the local ranchers at all to speak of. Maybe one or two. But my business was very good. I enjoyed it, and I enjoyed the people and being around them, doing work for them.
When did you complete your education then?
Well, after I came back, to the valley, I only had, I think, a sixth grade education, but I was able to. My math was good enough to be a machinist and all of those things, and I was constantly using figures for, you know, with the micrometers and things like that, and doing highly technical work. And after I came back here and went in business, by chance, one of my friends wanted me to take classes with him at the College of Sequoias. And I had never gone to college. In fact, I didn't go to high school for that matter. And so I went there just, you know, after I had my business and I was getting to be more prosperous, and my family and my two young babies. I just wanted something to do, you know, in the evenings. And apart from being with him, of course, but and so I went there, and I didn't know what to take. And he said, "Well, we'll just kind of guess at it," and we decided to take algebra. And I'd never had that before. I had no idea what it was like, and they didn't quiz us or didn't quiz me on my background or anything. So I started taking courses, and I found out that I could do college work without too much trouble. And I went to night school, I think, for about 8 years. And I got enough to graduate from COS, and I did.
Where is that located?
That's in Visalia. It's College of Sequoias, and it's a fairly large junior college. And then after, I think I got the 72 units, semester units there. And then after I did that, I went to take a special training in automotive. By that time, I had been in business for about 15 years. And 16, perhaps. And I went to school in the General Motors Training School in San Leandro. You know, it was free. I could go there. And by that time, I had a junior college degree. And so I went there, and we had to, one of the things we had to do in our training, we had to get up in front and, you know, kind of like teaching a class. And after I did it, well, then after I gave my presentation, well, then the teacher said to me, well, why don't you teach high school? And I said, well, you must be kidding. How would I teach high school? I don't have the training. And they said, well, you can be a vocational teacher. And I said, well, it takes 4 years or 5 years to get a credential. And, you know, he said, you can get a credential with the junior college degree in, and if you have 5 years experience in auto mechanics. And I said, well, I might think about it sometimes. And then a few years later, well, then I still stuck in the back of my mind, well, maybe sometime I might do that. And then you had to take a test in order to, that is the state, you know, University of California, to determine whether or not I was capable of doing those things. And I did. I took the test after about thinking about it for 3 or 4 years. I did, and I passed the test. And then it went on for a while, and I think after I was there 20 years, well, then by that time, they had issued me a vocational credential. And then the telephone, I was thinking, oh, maybe sometime I would like to teach. But then that's when teachers were really hard to find. That was in 67. The telephone rang, and it was the principal of the Tulare Union High School wanting me to come and teach auto mechanics and machine shop, which I'd already had the experience in North American and Shirilla Harwa too. And after I thought about it for a while, I thought, well, maybe I will, which meant I would have to sell my shop. And I had a orange grove there too by that time, selling my orange grove and so forth and moving to Tulare. And after thinking about it for a while, and I did, I took the job of teaching here at the high school. That was in 67. And then after I got to, in the summer months, and then I had off, see, to do what I wanted to do. Now I finished up my degree. Well, first I went to Berkeley at Cal, and then I finally got my degree from Fresno State University, and then I went back in the summers after that to the very same place where I was in the CCCs at Flagstaff and got my master's at Flagstaff there.
And what was your master's in?
Vocational education.
Mm-hmm.
And
pretty good for a fellow who didn't graduate from high school, huh?
Yeah, I guess I've heard you talk about high school dropouts, and I really wasn't a drop-in, to be honest about it. But I've enjoyed going to school, and I, even after I came here, well, then I got busy and got enough schooling to get my broker's license. Of course, some of that I already had because of schooling before, you know, mm-hmm. economics and so forth. But I've always enjoyed going to school. Probably still will.
This is the second interview with Frank Andy Maness on Friday, February 20th, 1981 at 12 noon. I just wanted to go back a little bit from last time. We discussed that you never actually lived through the death storms because you were in Arizona.
No, I didn't experience dust at all in Oklahoma. In fact, I think because of the time that I left there, and they really hadn't started the dryness, droughts hadn't actually started. And number two, we lived in an area where, like I said before, just the beginning of the trees, you know, where the trees were. And actually, the dust storms were worse than Beaver County, Texas, and Cimarron County, which is the panhandle of Oklahoma. So that's where the troubles really were. And in Texas, and I think sometimes maybe Colorado was just as bad with dust, and maybe more so than Oklahoma. So I think the tag that they put on that the dust was strictly an Oklahoma calamity was not quite right, because it's partly so, but not really. And so I didn't experience any dust at all.
Did you hear much about it from your family?
Yes, absolutely. Some of my friends from Texas that I was in the CCCs with that I mentioned were from Texas, and they had what they call dust pneumonia. Some of their relatives would take dust pneumonia. And if you had double dust pneumonia, well, then that was something very serious. And I remember that distinctly, of having friends that the relatives had double dust pneumonia. But it was something that occurred, and the farmers plowed up the grounds, and they didn't take proper care of the land, and then whenever we had the droughts and the winds, well, then that's what happened. But I personally didn't experience that, neither did any of my relatives.
You mentioned that they plowed up the grounds. Well, is that in connection with the Roosevelt program?
Before that, they would plow in a straight line, a straight row. In fact, they prided themselves on having straight rows. Mm-hmm. And then with the no rotation of the crops, they would plant cotton, year after year after year, and pretty soon the land began to deteriorate and not be productive, and then the winds and then the droughts, and then it brought on the dust storms. But it wasn't entirely the fault of the weather as much as the bad farming principles.
Do you think the people realized that at the time?
Well, perhaps they did a little bit, but not as well as they do now, not by a long shot. And now then you go back there, and how did they plow? They plow in contour circles, and they still have the maybe have rotation of crops. They would plant and now they plant the alfalfa and things like that, and it kind of tends to hold the. And then the CCC boys started planting trees during the Depression years.
Do you remember hearing very much about tractors at that time? Some people say they were tractoring off the land, that the tractors came and took the jobs from them.
Well, that is true.
Now,
of course, we were right at the transition of going from horses to tractors. Well, it was hard for the farmers to give up, to give up on using the horses. And some of them would and some of them wouldn't. In fact, my father said, well, we have 8 teams of horses and we have the grass and we have the facilities for the horses, and there's no point in us in trying to go to a tractor. However, we did buy a tractor that didn't run too well, and so we just gave up on that. But then all the ones that did succeed did go to tractors. But it was right in the transition of, from horses to tractors, and we didn't progress with the, neither did we own the land for that matter. And so the ones that did succeed and stayed with it, well then, I know my father went back after the Depression, back in after World War II, and visited some of our friends, and they said, well, we've gotten rich, but what happened to all of the people that lived like we did around surrounding? They had disappeared, and so it all had become big farms. But then they had made the transition from horses to tractors, and they were prosperous, but they were less of us, less of them.
Mm-hmm. I've also heard people say that the railroad rates were so high that farmers couldn't afford to grow and then transport their food, and that was the reason why some of them were forced to leave. Do you remember hearing anything like that?
Well, we didn't have that much of a problem there where we were at because the railroad went right through our little town. And I don't recall it being like that, but I have recalled them talking about that here in California whenever I came here. But I'm sure that that was part of it. And it still is, for that matter. Shipping oranges and stuff back east is quite a problem.
Mm-hmm. When you first moved to California, you moved in with your sister and your brother-in-law, and you described where they lived. It sounded as though you might have been disappointed with California. Would you say that was true?
Well, yes, it was true. That was definitely was true, because I had, it wasn't so much of a, well, it was just the economic conditions, I think, that disappointed me. And I loved the California. I loved the valley because it was a milder climate than I had been used to. And I loved the idea of being able to get fresh fruit. I loved that. But the economic conditions, and with no work, and the attitude of the people after I got a little better acquainted was rather negative, and it was the, especially it was the attitude after we would work for a rancher and I would see him on the street after I had completed the job maybe 2 weeks later, and he was an entirely different person. And I couldn't understand that. It was hard for me to understand it. I was disappointed in that respect. I hadn't been used to that type of thing.
Mm-hmm. It sounds as though in Oklahoma there was a community.
Absolutely.
Very close to
me. Right, very close. And I grew up with that type of a thing, and then you are thrust into this kind of a position. Well, then it made me wonder. In fact, as I said in the application, it was with a great deal of reluctance that I came back because I simply did not want to come back to that type of a thing. I was afraid that I was getting into that type of thing.
You felt a definite class structure then?
Yes, there was, and yet it was a class there between the ranchers and the workers, and there was a class between the town officials and the workers, and I can't understand it myself because I still can't, but it actually existed.
But you say you weren't really disappointed in the physical aspect.
No, absolutely not. I loved it. I loved it because I'd seen movies of it, and I liked the idea of them being able to irrigate the land and have all this wonderful fruit, in which we didn't have to any great degree in Oklahoma. See, we had in fact, our peach trees were little tiny peaches, and about the only kind of grapes we had would be the wild grapes, which were sour. And it was a wonderful place as far as I was concerned. And yet there was this abundance of fruit and vegetables, and still people were going hungry.
Did you come over the Tehachapi Mountains and do that?
Yes, it was quite a sight. As I said before, I rode the passenger train, and I bypassed the trouble that they were having at the border by being able to ride the train. And we came from Flagstaff, Arizona, to Barstow, and I got off of the train at 3 o'clock in the morning in Barstow. And I remember it was extremely hot at 3 o'clock in the morning. Of course, that was a hot time of the year. And I had waited until maybe 9 o'clock the next morning to catch a train from Barstow to Bakersfield, and we came through all those winding hills, and I thought, well, this is really spectacular. But I do remember coming over the Mojave Desert, and it was a real desert, and I thought, well, California doesn't look too well to me. But that was just part of the desert, and I realized it, and I was waiting. And I remember coming through Bakersfield, and they were having a parade. And of course, it was hot in Barstow, but it was doubly hot in Bakersfield, and that I distinctly remember coming through there, and I could look out the windows and see the parade, and it was they were having a good time. And I thought, well, maybe it's a good place to be.
You mentioned that you were able to avoid the troubles at the border because you were on a train.
Right, right.
What did you hear about?
Well, it was the same story that that had been circulated before, that they were turning them back unless they could show evidence of having sufficient money or show evidence of having relatives here that would furnish them work. And one of my friends, the librarian I mentioned to her a day or two ago that I was doing this project, and she said, well, I'm also Yamanoki. And I was 13 years old at the time, and whenever we came to California, well, they stopped my father for several days before they could come through, and she said it was very humiliating.
Did your sister and brother-in-law have any problems?
They had problems, yes, they did. finally, they let them through, but they took all of their food. The only thing they had was a few potatoes, small potatoes from Oklahoma, and things like that. And she was so disappointed that they took the food, and the food inspector, the egg inspector there, saw that she was so disappointed, and he said to her, oh, don't worry about it. He said, when you get to Bakersfield, you can get all the potatoes you want, much nicer than those, for $1, he said, for 100 pounds. And so she felt better about that. But they did have some problems. But she was quite a talker. And she persuaded them that they should let them through, and they did. But I think, too, that they did find out that it was unconstitutional for them to do that, but I think what actually happened was that if they could discourage them from coming in, they would, and if they could make it a little bit hard on them from coming in, well, then at least there would be that many less to have to support, I guess. But they really weren't supporting us from a standpoint of welfare. But
after you moved here and you were living with your sister and brother-in-law, how would you compare your economic situation with that of other Okies?
about the same, really. There's very little difference. And in fact, most of us didn't really have a study job. In fact, that was the goal that we were looking for, was a study job where we could have a constant income. But it just didn't exist.
Did you know of or ever see Okies that live, say, in the ditch camps or under bridges?
Well, I have never seen them actually along ditch camps, but I have seen them in some pretty poverty-stricken conditions that may as well be along a ditch camp, because they would be out of gasoline and out of food and everything else and not able to go any further. So as far as I'm concerned, there's very little difference in having to put up with that type of a situation and maybe camping by the creek. Now, whenever we would leave our cabin to go and find work, like on the west side, well, then we were just as bad off, because we had no place to stay. We would sleep in our cars and didn't have a tent, for that matter. But we would sleep in the cars until... that's where I encountered this passing out this poker chip type of thing where we would use at the stores. Highly resented that, because as far as I was concerned, it was unfair to have to go to a certain place to spend those things, and invariably the prices would be higher.
Mm-hmm. But you were better off than some of the people.
Absolutely.
Some of the people you knew. Did you know very many that perhaps lived on government aid or did not try to find jobs?
Actually, I did not know of too many that didn't try. Most of them did try, and very few of them were getting government aid for this reason. At that time, they had to live here a year. Now, I remember a program that was in existence at the time. It wasn't a program, it was an initiative. It was on the ballot. Let me explain a little bit and go back a little bit. One time when I went out to the cotton patch after I'd been here just a short time, to pick cotton, the leader of this group of cotton pickers said to me, "Ham and eggs." I said, "Ham and eggs?" And he it was pretty apparent that I didn't know what he was talking about, and he said, "Ham and eggs, everybody," and he said, "Ham and eggs." And then he said to me, "Well, what do you think about it?" And I said, "Well, I really don't know what you're talking about. I like ham and eggs, but I don't know why. Apparently it's something else." And he said, "Well, they're going to have initiative, or going to vote very shortly on initiative that was headed by a person by the name of Mac Lane." And what it consisted of was a kind of a Keynesian theory, like it was proposed by Keynes to President Roosevelt, and it was kind of a revolving thing, and it was a welfare type of thing, and it was the craziest setup outfit. It was very ambiguous. You couldn't tell for sure where the money was coming from, and I opposed that because I said, "Well, I felt like we didn't use the term, there's no free breakfast in those days. We used the term, well, if you're going to dance, you got to pay the fiddler." And I said, "Well, if you're going to dance, someone's got to pay the fiddler, and someone's got to pay this. So therefore, I'm against it." And so I got in a little bit of a trouble. But and it did go on the ballot, and believe it or not, it almost passed. And just a few votes more. However, I don't think it was the Okies that really put the thing on the ballot in the measure in the first place. And I don't think it was the Okies that almost made it pass, because for the simple reason that so many of us had not been here long enough to even vote. And secondly, we were moving around so much that I don't think that, well, in fact, I didn't vote all the time I was here. And I think that applied to a lot of others. And I don't think it was the Okies that promoted that thing. And the most of the Okies that I knew really didn't go in for welfare that much. But that was a very unusual measure that they had there. And then still the same person. Then there was this 30 every Thursday type of thing that they had. And it, I don't recall whether it was tied in with this or not, but they were going to use a script to, they would get this 30 pieces of script and they were going to take it to the store, and the store would honor it, and it would make the revolving circle and come back, and it was kind of a complicated thing. But I know some of the stores says, well, I'll have nothing to do with that because it just doesn't make sense, and they weren't going to. Some said, well, I will, because it's just as good as money. But that was another, could have been part of the same thing, or it could have been a different one, but it was another welfare initiative that both went down to defeat, but just by a small margin.
But you said you don't think the Okies really had that much to do with it.
That's my honest opinion. I don't think they really did, because they weren't eligible. So many of them did not register to vote because they didn't have time. You know, they were busy looking for jobs, or they were busy going from one place to the other. And, you know, you've got to be in a certain place a given length of time before you can even vote.
Mm-hmm. Had these measures been passed and adopted, and had they worked, do you think they would have benefited the Okies?
Well, I suppose they would, but of course we were only thinking of a hypothetical case in the first place. I don't think that they would have worried. Mm-hmm. That's my honest opinion, because it would have had to been paid for one way or the other by someone. Of course, it would have been the taxpayers of California that would have paid it, but I'm grateful that it didn't pass. Who knows? I don't know. But I probably would have taken advantage of it. But then I think that most of the Okies were anxious to have anything that would give them food and clothing. But I don't think that they were actually looking for welfare. I know I wasn't. I've never received one penny's worth of welfare, and I didn't want the welfare. But I wasn't opposed for someone else. If they wanted to go and get it, fine. But I did resent some of the ones that had been here for several years. That was maybe worked 11 days a week, and he was off the other 19 days, and yet he would make more money than I by working for a full month. And I kind of resented that, and because they were had a lot of free time and it seemed like they weren't trying to better themselves, but I don't think that they were the what I would term the Dust Bowl Okies that were drawing that. I think it was someone that had been in the area for several years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you think very many of the Dust Bowl Okies did that?
I don't think so. That's my honest opinion. I don't think so. I don't think so.
If they did, if there were some from Oklahoma, whether it was during the Dust Bowl or just before that, that came out here and were therefore called Okies. Do you think that maybe they were the type of people that would have done that back in Oklahoma too?
Absolutely. You're going to have that in every situation. You know, you'll have those kind of people. But what I'm talking about is the by and large of the group. You know what I mean?
Right.
I don't think that it would be true. But sure, you'll find that in even today, you know, and you'll find the same thing in every walk of life. You will have some of those people that would do those things, but I'm thinking of the group as a whole. I don't think that they were looking for handouts, and most of them were very hard-working people that really wanted to succeed. That's all I was looking for, and I'm sure that applied to my brother-in-law and my sister and all of my relatives. We were just looking for a chance to make an honest dollar and do our thing.
Mm-hmm. Do you think most people that were native Californians realized that?
At that time, they didn't. That time, they didn't, because I've had to make some pretty snide remarks to me, as if, for instance, after I started working, I have had them say to me, "Oh, where are you from, Anoki?" Well, I don't know of Anoki that can do anything very well, and I get so mad I would want to sock the guy. But that was the attitude that some of them had, and one fellow, I think I would have slugged him had he not been a cripple, and I saw that he was crippled, but he was a very sarcastic person, and I, just that type of thing is what we had to contend with most of the time. But by and large, though, people were nice. That is, but you'll find that the same as some of the Okies that that were looking for a handout. You also find some of the ranchers that were not honest too. But we did find a lot of ranchers that were very nice, like Mr. Gillespie and Jensen's, and some of the millers that I worked for. Well, you couldn't ask for nicer people.
Did you ever resent some of the Okies that were getting handouts and therefore giving the rest of you a bad name? Did it bother you that because of these people you were grouped together as Okies and then discriminated?
Well, I have tried to analyze why this connotation existed, and I think perhaps it was a... I did resent it, sure, but then I tried to figure out maybe it was a culmination of a lot of things that brought on this connotation. Perhaps it was the this type of thing, and perhaps of the our physical appearance as looking like a real bum, and perhaps not having the money to buy the things that we would like to buy, and coming to California in a worn-out car that wouldn't run too well, and not having sufficient money to get here, and all of those things, I think, and then...
You think the manner of speaking?
Absolutely, because it was a different type of speech, and it was something that we couldn't get away from, and some of the language that we used, I'm sure, wasn't up to par, but that didn't mean that they weren't good, hard-working people. They were. They just had a different accent, and it's something that we, regardless of how we tried to camouflage it, well, it was there, just like Peter in the Bible, you know, whenever Christ was being crucified. Well, then he said, well, I'm not part of him, but they said, well, you are too, because your speech defies you. Well, the same way with us, we couldn't get away from it. It was just something that was easy to detect by the natives or the people that lived here.
Some people feel that the Okies were used as a scapegoat, that California, as a part of the Depression, was doing poorly, and the people, some were out of work, and generally things were very bad, and then the Okies happened to come at that time, and that had it been any other group, they probably would have been treated the same way. They would have been discriminated against too.
Well, I think too that's true, because it was the economic situation that was, we were going through this transition from horses to tractors, and it made the elimination of a lot of people that had no place to go. And then too, I think the media had a lot to do with it. In other words, the newspaper and the radio, of course we had no television in those days, but all of those things contributed, and perhaps the news that they called us Okies. One writer said, well, would it made a difference had they called them Kansas or Arkies or something like that? Would that been made a difference? Perhaps it would, you know. But you take all of those things and you put them together, then you have, it turned out to, it was a stigma that was attached to being an Okie that I think was unfair.
You mentioned the media. Did you read newspapers very much at that time?
Yes, I did.
Do you remember what they said about Okies, how they were reported?
Well, they just mentioned of the trail of cars that existed leaving the Dust Bowl. In fact, this one picture, I guess, is a classic example of the average person that had to flee his place. I think it still exists in the some of the pictures, but it was, they didn't actually do it as a degrading thing so much as it is was a true portrayal of what existed. Then you put that together with the had them having to leave an economic situation, then along the roads the troubles that they had, and the sometimes I suppose the deaths that occurred along the road, and the people not having means of even burying their dead. They would have to sometimes, in the Graves of Wrath, it mentions that where some of them died in, who was it, the preacher Casey, preached the sermon. He had backslidden, yet they got him to say a few words and that type of thing. I think it actually, on a few occasions, that sort of thing did exist. And all of those things, I think, that type of thing, and the old cars that wouldn't run, and the economic situations all contributed to the stigma of being an Okie.
Since you mentioned Strangback, and you had read The Grapes of Wrath, and maybe you saw the movie, do you think that was a very accurate representation of what the Okies actually went through, and what the people...
Well, in some respects, it was quite accurate. The economic situations, and I'm sure that John Steinbeck did a tremendous amount of research in the preparation of his book. There's no question in my mind that he had it well versed in the things that he wanted to write about. And it was quite accurate. The economic situations were quite accurate. The people, like, for instance, what was his name? Tom Joad? Was he the... Tom Joad had returned from prison, and whenever he got back, well, then the houses were all gone, and his family... Well, that's quite typical. In fact, I had relatives, I suppose, that could be... depicted as almost a Tom Joad. In fact, I've remarked a few times, I think that I could have played Henry Fonda's part in Grapes of Wrath without rehearsing, almost. But it was quite accurate. The, for instance, I've had relatives that would go into religion, very much so like Casey. In those days, if you wanted to be a minister or a preacher, you were called by God. In other words, God would call you to be a minister, and sometimes they really weren't that prepared. Like the nowadays, well, they go to college for 4 years and they select the denomination of your choice, and you, whenever you come out, you're prepared. But that wasn't so in those days. It was, you got up in front, and I've heard of many times of wanting to be but a minister and called by God. And then I'm sure that was Casey's situation, and I have had relatives that were exactly like Casey. And they would be religious or want to be a minister for a short period of time, and that didn't work out, and the money didn't come in, and so they would change their occupation, and they would backslide, and they would be exactly like Casey. And the mother of Tom Joad, that I would say would was almost exactly like my grandmother, and she was quite defensive of, remember she was defensive of Tom Jode even from the law. Well, she would do everything to protect him. Well, that was a typical Oklahoma mother. I remember my grandmother protecting one of her own sons from the law. He had done some little something that really wasn't too bad, but whenever the law came to get him, well, she would hide him behind the door, and the law couldn't find him. But Tom Jode's mother was a typical Oklahoma mother from that point
of
view.
Some people have been bothered by the vile language.
Yes, now that is one portion of that I do not agree with John Steinbeck with, that it simply wasn't like that to any great degree. Of course you would find some of it, but it just wasn't like that, and I resented John Steinbeck using that kind of a language. I didn't use it.
Mm-hmm.
I still don't, and I know many of my friends did not. My relatives did not.
Make them look like very, very crude.
Well, and maybe that was one of the things that contributed. Of course, he didn't write the book until, 39, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
But then, of course, the stigma still extended beyond Depression days, too. And maybe that was part of the reasons why that it did continue on for several years.
Throughout most of the story, the Jodes were depicted as being solely concerned with their survival.
Well, that's true, because all we could think of was our next meal. In fact, that was the reason why I mentioned that I had completed the sixth grade. And it wasn't that my parents didn't want me to have an education. In fact, my grandfather always was a school teacher. But then he told me, he said, well, Frank, because you're crippled, I want you to get an education. My father wanted to. But what came first, an education or survival? Survival came first. And the same thing with them. It was quite true. It was either you take the first thing first, and survival was the most important. And so my father didn't say one word. I said, well, I want to quit school. I don't want to. And I mentioned, too, that I was having trouble with my stepbrothers, and he was away from home a lot, and I said, well, I'm going to quit, and maybe I'll go someplace else.
Mm-hmm. They also Steinbeck suggested in the book that many of the girls were promiscuous, and many of the people perhaps immoral or amoral. Do you think that was generally true?
No, it was not true. I mean, it's no more. It is. Now, of course, you will find that sort of thing in those days, and on a few occasions, of course. But it's no different whether it was in the Depression days or whether it's now or whether it was back in the Bible days. It's all the same as far as I was concerned. And I think there was something that was kind of unfair that for him to do that. And if I were a girl growing up in those days, I think I would have resented John Steinbeck saying that.
Mm-hmm. I think he also intimated that perhaps many of the Okies were not law-abiding citizens, beginning with Tom just being released from prison, and then several of the things they did along the way.
Let's think of it like this. They were law-abiding in their own way. In fact, maybe we had our own code of ethics that we went by. And of course, that was during the days whenever there wasn't any liquor to be had. And the only things that I can think of that they did that was against the law was that we had a tremendous amount of whiskey that you could buy just any place you wanted to go, just about, and everyone knew where it was at, and the county sheriff would have his own, it came in fruit jars, you know, a half a gallon fruit jars. That's either a quart fruit jar or a half a gallon fruit jar, and you could get it, any kind of sheriff drink his share of it, along with all the rest of us, and we had in our own home, but we didn't, the only time that we would drink it, if we had a bad cold or something like that, we would use a small amount, but I would say that probably we wouldn't drink more than maybe 2 half-gallons in a whole year for the whole family, but we would go and buy it whenever we wanted to. But apart from that, well, I don't think that we were any more unlawful than anyone else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think Papa, where he took artistic license,
you're right,
a little bit too seriously, and threw every
again the
possibility together and came up with.
And why did they make the whiskey in the first place? It was they couldn't sell the corn, and they couldn't make money working at other places because they couldn't find a job, and so that was an occupation for them, and they had whiskey stills, of course. But
throughout the Grapes of Wrath, health is a constant problem, and malnutrition.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. I had an awful lot of illness, and I think it was because of health problems that I mentioned before, that I had this osteomyelitis that I'm sure left me a cripple, but I am sure that it was a lack of medical attention, and I had a Bright's disease. I'm sure that was caused by an improper diet. I had malaria for summer after summer because we didn't know how to take care of the ourselves, and the mosquitoes would bite us, and all kinds of things like that. And it was just a thing that it was part of ourselves, really.
After you were here in California, do you think people had health problems? Say the Okies had health problems more often than the general population?
Well, until they started to, yes, they did have, but not as much, I don't think, because why? They could get good food and get good vegetables. And my grandfather died from pellagra. Now, pellagra, the doctors used to not know what it was caused from. But even my father was afraid that he would also die from pellagra. And guess what? After my grandfather died from it, my father took it. But then they found out what it was causing. It was a diet deficiency. And after my father took it, well, then it was no problem. It was just simply a matter of the proper vitamins and so forth, and that's all there was to it. But people used to die from it. Now, the people in California was not troubled with pellagra, but we were in Oklahoma. In fact, I have never heard of the anyone in California having pellagra. Because why? They have the fresh fruit and vegetables and those things, and they're more plentiful, and so it didn't exist here. And so from that point of view, I think that we were in better health after coming here than we were in Oklahoma, by far, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm. Some of the native Californians had accused the Okies of using the free hospitals here and health facilities. They thought in general they had more health problems.
Well, that's true. When we came here, that's true, I'm sure, because we weren't in the best of health, yet very determined, though, very determined to break out of this bond that we were in. In fact, whenever they would insinuate these things, and it would make me infuriated, I just was determined that I was not going to allow that to stop me. And I think that applied to a lot of Okies, really.
Mm-hmm. I've also heard some criticism of the Okie diet, because it had tended to be very heavy in the starches.
Heavy in starches and heavy with the pork. And so you can see why then we had plague rot. It was just that. See, it was that's what we grew up with. Now, as long as we were doing hard work, you know, hard manual labor, like pulling a cross-cut saw or something like that, then we could get away with that type of a diet, you know, and it really wasn't that bad. But then whenever, when trouble started is whenever we got easier jobs, and then we could no longer tolerate the pork grease and the pork and the greens to go along with it.
Mm-hmm. Do you think Marshall
Zelkis
did change their diet?
Well, I'm sure that he did. Especially after marrying a nurse. Mm-hmm. I sure did. But it was hard to change. It was hard to change to get away from that. And I used to like to use my bread to sop up the grease with. And to my wife, that was a no-no. But it was hard to change. Mm-hmm. But I'm sure that we did change. Definitely.
I know your sister had two children.
Well, she had more after that. I mentioned the two little girls that
to begin with,
right? Mm-hmm. And she had four. Mm-hmm, we'll tell them.
Do you remember if they had any particular health problems in their early
No, they didn't. In fact, they were quite healthy, and except for the two which were born in Oklahoma, the rest of them were born right here in California, and they grew up to be quite normal children, and they were quite successful. And
were you living with them when they entered school here?
No, I wasn't, because by that time I was around them, of course, but I was not living with them, because by the time they entered school, we were getting up into World War II, and by that time we were in a different position, in a different location from here. But I think they were maybe 44 before any of them went to school. Maybe not that, but around 43 anyway, I guess, by the time that some of them entered, the oldest one. Mm-hmm. But I think, too, that the California schools have been very good in helping the Okie children, but maybe at first they weren't. And I've heard the accounts of some of the teachers not really thinking too highly of the Okie children as when they came into school, because maybe their dress and the language they used and different accent and so forth.
Mm-hmm. We were talking for a moment about the stripes here in the valley. I wondered if you were involved in any of them.
No, I was not. They did have some strikes that I knew about. For instance, they had a strike at Tagus Ranch here, which was one of the largest ranches, I guess, in California. That is a fruit ranch, 6,000 acres. And I thought it was kind of unfair, too, that some of the things that Marriott did in enticing the Okies to come here with all of his circus and everything. And
Could you tell me a little bit more about that? Did he send flyers back
yes,
to Oklahoma?
Yes, all over, really. You would find them not only in Oklahoma, but you would find them in Texas as well.
Did you ever see one yourself?
I did not see any, but I know that they existed because I heard so much about them, and I have friends that did see them. Mm-hmm. But then maybe he would have had all of the help that he needed had he not done that. But he did have all of this vast supply of help there,
at any given time, and there were a few of the people that did cause disturbances and wanting to strike, but it was a very small group that did that. And because of the fact that Marriott had maybe 7 people to take the place of everyone that quit, the strikes were very ineffective. They just didn't get off the ground. And I'm sure that the same thing happened in the southern part of the valley, like Weed Patch and those places. Maybe somewhere around Woodville, I think there was a labor camp there, and I'm sure the same thing happened there. And maybe in the books of the Grapes of Wrath, well, didn't it mention that Tom and his family went to Woodville and they met the highway patrol whenever he was going into this place where he was supposed to go. And first off, they went to Weed Patch to solicit help. And he told Tom and the family where to come to, and then he went to Woodville. But whenever he got to Woodville, then there was this roadblock of highway patrolmen telling him, well, what are you going to do? Where are you going to go? And he said, well, I'm going into this place to work. Well, whenever he got there, well, then the strikers were there, but then he went ahead and went on through. Why did he go through? Not that he didn't want to honor the picket line, but because he simply needed to work. And there was the same thing happened here with the Tagus.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever cross the
picket line? I never did. No, I never did. I know, but I know of a few. But by and large, they were very ineffective. It just didn't happen. It's not like today, you know, that Cesar Chavez can have a boycott and the pickets, and they're very effective.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the lawmen. Do you think very many Okies were harassed at times by the law?
Yes, they were. Yes, they were. In fact, I have been harassed, but I had a way of maybe talking my way out of some of those situations. But I have been harassed for them. I have been stopped by the highway patrol. But I will say this: I think the highway patrol probably were nicer than, as a whole, than some of the local sheriffs or local marshals. And in those days, they rode motorcycles. They didn't have cars. They had motorcycles, and I've been stopped by them for no reason at all. And I've had, like I told you about the one that harassed us because we complained because the fellow wouldn't pay us the bonus that he had promised. Well, as far as I was concerned, it was nothing more than harassment, perhaps to deter us from doing anything about collecting this 5-cent bonus. I think that was partly that. And, of course, the sheriff was a good friend of the rancher that accused us of stealing the pruning shares. And so what did he do? He came to our house and harassed us. And one time, a car stopped, and it was in the dark, and it was at night, and we wanted to push the car to a light so that people wouldn't strip it. And we pushed the car almost for a quarter of a mile so we could have it by the light. And it wasn't in a restricted area. And so we left it there so they wouldn't strip it. So we went back the next morning, and we had a ticket for no reason at all. And we had to pay a fine for parking our car in the wrong place. And as far as I was concerned, it was nothing more than harassment. And of course, they could look at the car and tell that it belonged to some Hokie and things like that. And they threatened to put me in the hoosegow. And that was whenever they were having the whiskerina and contest. And I was never able to grow a beard very well, and so I didn't. But they harassed me some over that. And
But they did harass some of them much more than I. But I didn't suffer from that too much.
You mentioned that the townspeople also, let's say store owners or...
Yeah, they were.
...in town would also...
Yes, they were very snide. In fact, going to the Safeway store over this same Whiskerina thing, the clerks would harass me for no reason at all. And in fact, he threatened to call the townspeople and have me thrown into the Huskow, and he could very easily tell that I was just getting in from the fields and things like that. And just the snide remarks that they would make would kind of got me. But if we had money, it is, you know, it wasn't too bad, but the same thing goes back to the, if we had money to spend, well, fine. If we didn't, well, then get out of here. And if you're going to do nothing, well, don't do it here, type of thing. And then the same way with the farmers. I have no more use for you, so therefore, why should I speak to you?
You mentioned that this continued to some extent during and after World War II.
Yes, it did. After, it wasn't as bad after World War II. For instance, after I came back and I was successful to some degree in saving my money, and I bought this auto repair shop, and I started business. In a small town, it is usually acceptable, and it still is, and it was even before, to invite the new business to participate in being perhaps a member of the Chamber of Commerce, or a member of the Lions Club, or a member of the Kiwanis, or something like that. And sometimes, you know, if you're a good business person, well then, maybe even a member of the Masonic Lodge. They, you know, they don't ask you to be a Mason, but what they do, they will take and ask you if you would like to make application to be a Mason, and things like that. Well, when I went into business there, none of those things happened to me. None of them. For several years, for 9 years. And not only that, neither did I get business from the same type of ranchers that, you know, that I'd worked for before. I just didn't. I think partly because I was in competition to some of the established auto repair shops that was in existence there before I came, and partly because I was a Nokie. But gradually it started fading away, little by little. And then after 9 years, they invited me to be a member of all of those things. And I was. I was a member of the Chamber of Commerce. I was president of the Chamber of Commerce for several years. I was a, after 9 or 10 years, they asked me to be a part of the Public Utility District, and I was president of that. And they asked me to be a part of the Lions Club, but how long did it take? It took 9 years, to 8 or 9 years for that sort of thing to materialize and for it to gradually go away.
Did you know that other people who were not Okies and started businesses were Okies?
Absolutely. They would even come. And that was the part that I couldn't understand at first. First, one of my competitors, I was a machinist along with the being a garage mechanic, and I would do auto machine work for other garages. They were my competitors, yet they would come to me because I was a machinist to do this machine work. And I remember on one occasion where the president came to my place of business and solicited the membership of one of my competitors, and me standing right there. And he, knowing that that I also was not a member, and it infuriated me, really. And, you know, I thought, well, what kind of a character is that to come to my place of business and solicit my competitor to be part of his organization.
Mm-hmm. Did you know of other people from the OT background that had experienced things similar to this?
Yes, yes, yes. But again, it was a gradual thing, kind of like the Japanese, whenever they first came back from World War II, there was opposition to them at first. In fact, we had signs outside of Ivanhoe in 46, whenever they started coming back, no Japs wanted. And so what happened there? The Japanese people came back and they started doing good work, you know, and having the farms back and so forth, but it took a long time for them to overcome this situation, and it also took a long time for us to overcome the stigma of being Anoki. But it gradually faded away, and I'm happy.
Do you think it's still there to some extent now?
Very small amount. And in fact, it doesn't bother me one bit if someone wants to call me an Okie, fine.
Do you think that connotations to the word Okie have changed since?
Yes, it has. Yes, it has. I'm sure it has.
And what did it mean then if someone called you an Okie?
Well, it was a degrading thing. It was a degrading thing then for, because of the media that had in Grapes of Wrath, that it implied all of those things. That it was a degrading thing, and it just made me mad. It made all of the other Okies mad too.
Mm-hmm.
But however, we didn't say too much about it. We didn't like it.
If someone called you or someone else an Okie now,
I would laugh about
that call to mind. What?
Well, I would laugh about it. In fact, I would just think, well, just like Merle Haggard in his song, "I'm Glad to Be an Okie from Muskogee." You know, it's just it doesn't bother me. And I thought that it was kind of cute the way that he put that in his song. But it doesn't bother me. And I think maybe the song that he...
I think some people that are not in the least bit from the Okie heritage are not from Oklahoma, not from the... The
Dust Bowl
at all are called Okies. Yeah.
Well, of course, what does Okie mean, really? It makes something different, but then that's true. It could be they're from Arkansas, or it could be from Texas, but I think it generally implies that they're from either Arkansas or Oklahoma or Texas, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it's just something, you know, that I hope it never happens again.
I wanted to go back just a little bit. When we were talking about Roosevelt and some of the programs he had in the 30s, did you follow politics very much then? You said you read the newspapers.
Yes, I did. I did read the newspapers a lot, and my father used to talk to me a lot about the... about the politics, and he followed it quite closely. And that was one of the parts about it that we couldn't understand of the things that he had implemented, such as plowing up every other row of the cotton, and maybe killing the hogs, and I think here in California, what were they doing? Burning the oranges. And that was a program that was instigated by Roosevelt. That was one of the mistakes, I think, that he actually made. Some of his programs were quite good. For instance, I was part of the CCCs, and I really think that that was one of the programs that that he had that was good, and I benefited from it personally. I learned to trade from it. But apart from that, I'm not for sure. Well, perhaps the WPA Work Progress Administration did help people. But apart from that, I'm not for sure that some of the programs he had, such as I mentioned, plying up of the cotton and the killing of the hogs, and I think they were paying them to not raise hogs. I heard a cute joke about one farmer said, well, if President Roosevelt is going to pay him not to raise hogs, he was not going to raise the very finest. It's kind of tricky. Mm-hmm. But that's one of the things I think that he did make mistake in, and that sort of thing is, yet people were what? They were starving, and all of these things were going to waste, and that was something that my father could not understand, neither could I. And yet you can't blame Roosevelt too much, because he was stepping into a situation that was very bad. I don't remember exactly how many people were unemployed at that time, but it was quite high.
Mm-hmm. Some people that I've talked to hold Roosevelt personally responsible for the things that happened to them. For instance, if they lost their jobs on the farms in Oklahoma because of his programs and had bad times after that, they deeply resent him. Do you think very many Okies did feel that way?
Well, I'm sure that I know some did. I know my father did. In fact, my father was a staunch Republican, and he never did think too highly of Roosevelt, and he maintained all along that had Roosevelt left things alone like Hoover's idea of doing it and letting the country work out its own economic problems, he thinks that maybe it would have been much better. But he was against this vast giveaway program that they had in those days, and there was some opposition to that, and there certainly was.
When World War II came, you described how you moved to the Los Angeles area,
mm-hmm.
and went into the defense industry.
Right. Well, I worked at, when I left here, I went, as I mentioned before, I could not get employment, or really I didn't try very hard, but I felt like it was a kind of a fruitless part in trying to get a job here as an auto mechanic, even though I did have some experience in the CCCs. But then at the outbreak of the war, then I did leave my sister and her husband and went into Santa Monica, which is a nice town, and the situation there was entirely different, and I immediately went to work at the Chrysler place. And but then I only worked there for a few months, and then then of course, because of the war, we stopped getting cars, and we no longer could stay that. And I went to work at Douglas Aircraft, and again, I experienced some negativism from the people that I had worked for here in the valley. In the defense plan at that particular time, well, the security was very strict. In fact, you had to go back in several years to make sure that they weren't getting someone in that would sabotage the plant. I was not able, even after working for some of these people for quite a lengthy time, and I'm sure that they remember me quite well, but I could not get them to answer a questionnaire as to my whereabouts, not from one, not even one of them could I get them to answer. And Douglas Aircraft Company got on to me, because they said, well, hey, there's too much space here that's unaccounted for. They thought maybe I was in jail, or maybe I was in some foreign country or something like that. And I had a terribly hard time of convincing them that that just wasn't the truth. They said, well, you write to them. You know, they had written them. And they said, well, you write and see what you can do. And I was never able to get not even one of them to answer. Again, that was the, well, we're through with you, so why should we help out?
Mm-hmm. And did you finally get that situation straightened out so you could keep your job?
Well, I'll tell you what happened. It still really wasn't straightened out. And they were still after me. And I mentioned before that I really didn't like it at Douglas because of the no windows and it was quite noisy. So I deliberately quit there and went to work at a different place in West Hollywood, which was a machine shop for Cirillo Aero Tool Company. And I worked there most of the war as a machinist, and I came out a journeyman machinist. But then after I left there, I went to work for what was North American Aviation, which is now North American Rockwell. And I worked there until I went to went into business for myself in 1946.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds as though when the war came, things got a lot better for you.
Oh, yes, very much so. In fact, I started getting more money, and people's attitude changed at me. In fact, in the defense plant, well, they didn't look on me as a Noki or anything else. They just looked on me as just another worker.
Did you notice that many of the other workers in the defense industries were also Okies?
Yes, yes indeed. In fact, some of the really good workers and the top help were Okies, and then this negativism began to disappear fast. Yes, I noticed that. I worked with quite a few Okies that did quite well. And my brother-in-law, I got him a job, you know. Brought him in the very same plant at Cirillo's, and he worked there, and my sister, and he lived close by. And
when you came back up into the valley, as you told me before, your wife kind of talked you into it, and you were very, very reluctant to come back here.
I'd be very honest about it, I didn't want to come, because by that time I was prosperous there, and I thought, well, why should I go back to this spot where I almost starved to death, you know? And I just thought, well, I just... inwardly I felt like, well, maybe it's different, it's different. And by that time my father had moved to Ivanhoe. And that was, I was getting pressure from him. He said, well, listen, we need you here. We need you in this little town, and there are a lot of Oklahoma people here. Come here and be here. And I said, well, I don't know. I remember what it was like. My father wasn't here during the Depression. I was. And I said, well, maybe I will think about it. And then I was still working at North American Aviation. And finally I said, well, okay. And I took my money, and then I bought out this auto repair shop in Ivanhoe, and it was an older building, and I remember that I kept it there, and I really wanted a nicer, newer place of business. And at that particular time, the prices were escalating, you know what I mean, just like they have been the last few years. And this business that I bought the building and the whole thing. And I was able to sell this after 1 year and double my money, and I built myself a new one. And I got a nice location, and I got a little bit of opposition from the person that I sold it to, because I was going back in business. I told him I was not leaving town, but I was going to have a business some other place. And so I went in and had a nice new building, and I kept it there for, well, I only kept that one business for 1 year, and then I kept the other business 20 years.
Although you had some problems with the townspeople and the farmers around as far as the success of your garage went to begin with, it sounds as though you were successful.
I was, because...
And were you glad that you came back here?
Yes, yes indeed. In fact, my reluctance went away, you know, because whenever I came back and the little town was made up predominantly with people from Oklahoma and Missouri, even though I was not getting absolutely no work from the ranchers, but I was getting a tremendous amount of work from the townspeople, the little townspeople, because they were people like myself. And I would, and by that time I had become quite skilled, and I had equipped my place of business quite well with the proper machinery, and I had really more work than I could possibly take care of, and I was real happy. I was prosperous, and it was something that I liked to do. And
mm-hmm. Are you glad that you came to California?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Well, not from the very beginning. I thought, well, that's a bad deal.
Right.
But I'm so happy that I came, and it's just something that I... I'm glad I'm here, and I don't want to leave. Never will.
Did you ever want to go back to Oklahoma?
I have gone back a few times. In fact, I went back, and my wife and I drove back 2 summers ago, and I went to my hometown. It was the first time that I'd been back there since I left. And that was many, many, many years. And it was kind of ironic. I went into some of the places I recognized and some of the places that I didn't, but I went into a cafe and I thought, well, I will go in and I will pick out someone of my own age. Then I will ask him, how long have you been here? That was going to be my leading question. And then if they would say, all my life, well then, I would try to figure out then who they were and so forth. And so the first person I picked out, and I asked them in the little cafe there, how long have you been here? His answer was, 15 minutes. I'm from Ventura, California. And I said, well, you're not the person I'm looking for. But I did find some other people that I went to school with in grade school. And it was kind of enjoyable.
Do you think that your life has been better in California than it would have been had you stayed in Oklahoma?
I think so. I really do, because it's been more fulfilling. And I've accomplished some of the things that I wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's part of life, really, if you can do the things you like to do, you know. And I think there's nothing any worse than not doing what you want to do. And I have been prosperous, and we have traveled a lot, and I know that my wife and I have been in just about every nation in Europe and part of Asia, places like that. And during her, you know, and worked at the school, and of course had my salary and her salary, and we had plenty of money to do the things that we wanted to do, and we still do. But it hasn't come easily. It's been a lot of hard work to do the things, and that was one of the things that I tried to point out to some of the minority students. You know, this give-up attitude that some of them have. Well, and I said, well, look, you just... don't tell me that, because if you really will try hard enough, well then I know by first-hand experience that you can accomplish some of these things.
Mm-hmm. Well, because you feel good about what's happened to your life since then, and you've been successful and gotten quite an education, when you look back at the time from, say, 1936 or so, and then when you came to California, and those times that were very hard, and you say at times you were near starvation, how do you feel about that in general? Do you have very negative feelings about that period in your life?
No, I do not. I feel like it was something that happened to us that we had no control over. In fact, one of my Okie friends described it as like having a bull by the tail and not knowing how and when to turn loose of it. It was something that we didn't know how to control, something we had no control over, and it was but yet we were determined to, at least I anyway, and I'm sure a lot of the others, we were determined that we were going to somehow or other break the bonds of depression and break the bonds of negativism that existed.
Well, you did very well. Not very many people could overcome some of those things and get that.
Well, a lot of them did. It was just a...
How about your children?
Well,
how
I have two sons, yes, and both of them, one is married and one isn't. One is a, well, in fact, this is his picture here. He lives in Dallas, Texas, and he's married, and he has a degree in electronics, and he's married. They have no children yet, but they've been married several years. And then the other son was in the service. However, he graduated from College of Sequoias, and then he went into the Air Force, and he was in the Air Force during the Vietnam War. And now then, he is taking his GI training, and he's a senior in college, and so he'll be graduating probably either this spring or maybe late summer. And I'm real proud of our children. They've done quite well. But they tease me a lot about being an Okie, but I think they're kind of proud of me in a way.
Mm.